Blog Talk Radio.
Okay. Hope this works. Okay, are we coming through now?
Yeah, I can hear you. You know, it says, hello, welcome to Blog Talk Radio. Hold on, you'll be able to hear the show. And then I heard unmuted.
Okay, so it's giving me the same problem. What I'm going to do, though, is call in from my phone, and I'm going to move to another room where I have better reception. Because what it was doing is dropping my call.
Oh.
And then I got to figure out what the hell is going on for the next show. But, okay, so host calling. Okay, it's pissed off at me because the host has already called in. I'm going to call in as a guest. Okay. So I've got myself dialed in.
Okay. I'm dialed in. We can hear each other.
Mute the computer's mic.
Whoa.
Did you hear like a bunch of sounds within sounds?
Yeah. Echoes in and echoes.
Okay. I think we're good now. Because I called in the same way you did.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm going to just move somewhere where I know I have a good cell phone reception.
Okay.
Yeah, man, that was annoying.
Well, it only did that echo.
Sorry about
for
that.
A moment. No, it's fine.
Yeah, because what it was they had, like, I was connected to the show through two different microphones at once.
Oh, yep.
So it's a really weird effect.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Which is what I was... Yeah, that was my greatest fear, was that. being the whole episode.
Welcome to the echo chamber.
Right, you got to be on LSD for this episode to make sense. yeah, so
it does sound a little like you're inside a chamber. At least I can hear your voice. I mean, it's clear, but it has a little chamber effect.
Yeah, that's actually the house. Because where I moved in the house, there's like these vaulted ceilings.
So big space.
Big space. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go in my car. It will be nice and quiet. And then we should be cooking. All right. That's the thing with technology. It has to work perfectly. Otherwise, it sucks. You know?
Well, yeah. I mean, for sure, all the digital stuff. You know, the old mechanical stuff, you could have, you know, some issues with it, and it still functions, but...
Right. It's all, like, really amazing, but if one thing's off...
Yes.
It's just everything goes to shit.
Right. It's very easily disrupted.
All right. So, hey, Neen.
Yeah.
You can go back inside. I'm having issues inside, so I'm going to record it outside now. So I'd like to kick you inside, please. My brother's like playing guitar. I kicked him out because he was going to mess with the sound. So now I went outside and I'm asking him to go in. Okay. Getting in the car. Should be nice and quiet in here. Acoustics. All right. I love being in the car because it's it's a free place. It's like your spot, your space.
No, I know what you mean.
You
know? A lot of security inside that bubble. Yeah,
a lot of security, and it's the only place you can be loud without anyone hearing you. You know what I mean? You
mm-hmm.
listen to music
yeah.
loud. You can talk loud. You can, and you're just this moving space you own.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. It's a very interesting phenomena. It's both very public and visible, you know, but at the same time, it's very sort of private and isolated. And I'm hearing a little echo of my own voice, so maybe that's just my phone.
I hope so. Fuck, I don't know. We're just going to record it, and hopefully it works. If not, I'll, like, change the services I use or something. But I think we're all right. I don't hear any echoes.
Okay.
But, yeah, so my guest today is Bernard McGrane. He is a professor at Chapman University. My
alma mater. Alma
what
mater.
What is it?
I think it's alma mater.
My alma mater.
Because I got
okay.
you know, New York, sometimes so, yeah. My New York City accent comes out, so I'm not sure, but I think it's alma
messes
mater.
Messes up your Latin.
It messes up everything.
Why is it Latin that they use?
In terms of, I guess Western civilization.
For university-related shit.
Yeah, Greek and Latin.
Greek and Latin, huh?
Yeah, that was, kind of the fundamental script, the fundamental language that almost all the, you know, the knowledge, the books and everything was sort of preserved in. And it actually had a long staying power, you know, thousands of years.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a pretty good run. So it's like a throwback to the beginning of it all.
Yeah, I think so. And most in terms of our education, you know, most well educated, but you know, educated people for centuries. You know, definitely part of the education was learning Latin and learning Greek, and then using those languages. I mean, you know, the Pope just came here, and his English isn't too hot, but, you know, he's got a lot of Latin under him, as well as his Spanish.
Right. Pretty good for a Pope. I thought it was pretty solid.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
But, you know, you understand him.
Oh, sure, sure.
You would think that, I mean, I don't want to poke holes in the church, but... You know, I just feel like if you were the voice of God, you should be able to speak every language, right? I mean, God would, I would think he'd be like, here's all the languages, you know?
I don't think it quite works
need
that
like
way.
A, doesn't quite, not, like, that was too much to ask. But all Catholic jokes aside, I do love this Pope. I think he's like uniting the world, really. He seems like he's being a leader when there's a vacuum of good leadership, you know?
Sure. No, I'd agree, definitely. I mean, everyone that I know that watches said, I love that guy, you know? One of the most telling comments I heard was someone from San Diego who, she was given the offer and she took it to fly all the way to wherever, I guess, I think it was either Philadelphia or Washington, in order to be, you know, see him, be in his presence. And she said, I've been a Catholic for like 45 years, and for all the other popes, she said, you know, I don't think I'd cross the street to go see them, but I would go across the country to see him because he resonates kindness and spirituality. And, you know, that sort of hit it, you know, right on the head. He's not a political figure. He's a leader, like you said, and he's deeply spiritual.
Yeah, and he's taken steps to modernize the church. I think that's why everyone likes him, because I'm Catholic. Because, like, once you become Catholic, it's like, permanent. It's
yes.
You can't confirm
yourself.
No, you can't
un-Catholicize. No, you can't unlearn.
Which I liked. I liked it when I got... I've been baptized, I think, how many times have I been baptized? At least twice. So, like, I was... I think I was baptized as a baby. I got baptized when I was a teenager in, like, a non-denominational church. And then... You know, like, kind of towards the end of high school, I got really into this movie called Boondock Saints. My brother and I kind of got into our Catholicism. And, you know, we got confirmed officially because we hadn't done that before. Mm-hmm. And so I have my bases covered, you know. I'm like, totally – I just wanted to make sure I was fully, like, insurance-wise, I was covered. You know, and I'm so glad I did it, just in case, like, it's true. My name's on the list just in case the stuff I think is silly turns out to be the case. Like,
sorry, Nico, that's not going to work.
Argument.
You gotta, huh?
No, it does work, though, based on like, what most Christians say. It does work. Like, you can't, because you're like permanently forgiven. So it's like it doesn't matter what happens from that point. I mean, people would, there's different arguments, but for the most part, people believe that like once you take that step, you're all set. Like, no matter what you do,
you take
one step, you're covered. You're on the list.
Okay, once you take what step?
If you're not Catholic, most Christians believe you accept Jesus into your heart, which I don't know how you measure that. It seems like you're just like, I accept, you know, it's like an emotional thing, I guess.
Sure.
I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, when people say that, then most modern Christians say that that's all. You don't even need the ceremony. Like, you just say that and you're set. Catholics, you pretty much need you need to get the baptism, I think, is the kind of the rules. There's probably like an appeals process if you had one scheduled and died in the meantime, or I imagine there's like some purgatory attorneys who can process some paperwork and still get you in and under, you know, mitigating circumstances, what I'm sure be taken into
consideration. But, you know, they believe for the most part, like, once you do that, you're forgiven forever, and which is a really good deal. And it's kind of like, I feel like, just as someone who works in sales now,
mm-hmm.
it reminds me of, this conversation is kind of going all over, this is what we were planning on talking about, but it reminds me of these kind of scams that that people would do via email and stuff, where it's one of those things where you're like 90% sure it's bullshit, but if it is true, it's such a good deal that it's like worth wasting the $100 or whatever. Like that kind of famous Nigerian king email scam, you know, where they're
Oh,
you know, our king's like imprisoned right now, and he just needs some, like, you to front him like $20 so he can pay his bail, and as soon as he gets back, he's gonna give you like $1 million, or because that's like nothing to him, or you know, some weird story like that. But the mm-hmm. upside mm-hmm. is so huge that it's like, I just spent $100 on these, you know, these sneakers I don't even like it's worth it. It's worth taking a shot, you know. So if you get enough people to use that reasoning, that money can really add up, and that's how those scams work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think religion, because what's that famous argument? There's a really famous.
You just laid out Pascal.
Aquinas.
Well, what you just laid out was
Pascal's wager.
Yeah, that's what you just did.
Yeah, that's it.
In terms of the value, you know, you should if you adhere to this faith at death. Two things will happen. Either you will have eternal life in, you know, in paradise, or you will be absolutely nothing, and you won't even remember the wager or anything else. So really, in a sense, you have nothing to lose, and you have, you know, eternity to gain.
And that's a deal closer right there.
Yeah, yeah.
That's hard to argue from a, like, worried about yourself standpoint, you know? But, I always thought it was bullshit, though, because I thought Pascal's wager was bullshit in that, for one, I think your intention should matter, where, you
yeah,
know, otherwise everyone's going to say, yeah, okay, I accept Jesus in my heart. Like, why wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's why I think, but I also think it's bullshit in that it presumes two options when really there's an infinite possibility.
Yes, and it also assumes a kind of ultimate selfishness. I'm doing this
yes.
for my own soul.
Exactly.
You know, and
which
I think
defeats the purpose.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you get a good sense of that from the Pope, that, you know, that, like I said, it sort of resonates with spirituality. Is, you know, he's not thinking too much about himself. He's just... you know, whatever needs to be done politically that he can do, and you know, there's a generosity of spirit in there that's just palpable.
Yes. Yes, and he's not trying to sell you on a religion or condemn you for
right.
something you do. You know, he's not embodying the stereotypical Catholic principles of, you know, just making you feel guilty, making you feel like if you don't belong to this club, like, you're fucked. He's embodying something
yeah.
completely different.
Yeah, there's genuine kindness there. Genuine kindness, and, you know, and at least that's what I, you know, sensed and felt and heard. Genuine kindness and generosity. And, yeah, without any of the sort of, you know, there's such a long heritage of the legal dimension. You know, you have to do this or this happens, or,
right.
you know, the punishment dimension and the fear dimension, all that is sort of gone. And the law dimension, it's like all gone. It's just kindness.
Yeah, and that's
yeah.
universal. Like, that transcends religion, just that understanding that it's like I feel like that's just a core thing we understand. And when we feel that and when we sense it and it's genuine,
yeah,
that's the way it's supposed to be. And you know, let the chips fall where they may. If that's how you're, I don't know, if that's how you're living your life, then I don't think there's a single person in the world that would say,
you're going to be tortured forever because you didn't join the right. You know, it makes no sense.
Now, there
like,
are people that will
really
say that, but...
But you know what I mean? Like, they wouldn't really believe it. Like, even those Westboro Baptist Church guys, like, if you put them face-to-face with someone who's genuinely kind, like a Dalai Lama or whatever, I think that they're maybe they'll keep up appearances and keep saying the same thing, but I really don't think they'd believe that any God would condemn someone who's just provably good.
Sure. No, I agree.
But let's hone it in a little and talk about what I originally contacted you to talk about. So our topic today is going to relate to the Syrian refugee crisis, which by now I'm sure everyone listening is aware of. To summarize what's going on, just in case someone's not aware, it's a very complex issue, but what happened was basically there's a huge civil war in Syria. The government led by Assad is fighting, and has been for years, fighting different rebel forces, ranging from like Al-Qaeda to ISIS to who knows, and there's just this terrible civil war, all these people vying for power, and it's destroyed the country. And so all of these people who escaped death or, you know, induction into an army they didn't want to fight for or what have you, they fled, basically. And now I guess enough time's passed that they're reaching Europe and reaching these different countries, and they need somewhere to live. Like, they don't have a home. So imagine, like, thousands and thousands and thousands of homeless people walking towards your country. And now it's really a test of character for these different countries to say, will you take care of these people? Will you kick them out? Will you let them pass? Will you, you know, it goes back to these ancient ideas revolving around borders and ownership of land and culture, and you are with us, you're not allowed to be a part of what we are. You're, you know, and you hear Donald Trump embodying that kind of, I don't know if you'd want to call it a value, but that commitment to the, would hegemonic be the right word? You know, like that, just this, we have a culture, you're not allowed to be a part of it, you're a problem that we don't have time for. That's kind of the message he's sending with all the immigrant talk. And that's what you're seeing actually in practice from a lot of European leaders, where they're just not letting these Syrian people come to their country.
Yeah, I think.
And so we're going to discuss that. And I reached out to Professor McGrane, because he's my favorite professor I've ever had still. And he taught a class. Do you still teach that class?
The Death, Self, and Society? That one? Or?
Yes.
Yes, I do.
Why don't you tell them what that class is?
Well, sort of like what the title says, Death, Self, and Society.
All right, summed it up.
The first segment, you know, I have sort of different segments to it. There's sort of a whole logic of development. The first section is a sort of existential dimension, encountering probably the most difficult of all dimensions, my own death, to really come up against the truth of my own death, my mortality, you know, that I will die. And it's very, very, very difficult to access that, you know. It's actually one of the ancient sort of sayings in the Eastern world is, you know, it's the greatest miracle on earth is a human being can look around and see all his ancient relatives have died, people that he's known has died, you know, previous generations have died, other people around the world are dying right now, and but it's not going to happen to me, you know.
Right.
And that's a big one. That's there's a lot of layers and levels and subterranean levels of denial. And,
yes.
And, you know, distancing from that. So the first segment of the course was, you know, really encountering my own death. And then I go into, we look at sort of the contemporary medical situation of death and dying for, you know, how medicine looks at it, how doctors have looked at it. I use Kubler-Ross's On Death and Dying. There's a really good recent book by Atul Gawande. I love his name. He's a cancer specialist and a surgeon. And, you know, it's sort of very critical about the established distancing away from death that our medicine, you know, that is a big part of the way we practice medicine. And then I look at...
And that we just isolate people who are dying from society, if I remember correctly. That was kind
of what we talked about in
class, right?
Yeah, that's one component of, you know, isolating from others. And the other component is with the ideal of somehow we have this faith that, doctors can do everything today in a hospital and they can do things. So we've got to fight death no matter what. And, you know, we'll take whatever measures we can. You know, and it turns into, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars a week to have someone all hooked up. And you know, our medical technology is so skilled that we can keep people on sort of, you know, survival mode, you know, almost in suspended animation for a year on these, you know, intensive care wards.
And this is something that's unique to our culture, correct?
This,
to a degree. Modern America.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean,
the rest of the world throughout history didn't feel like death is the enemy. Let's stay alive as long as humanly possible, you know, regardless of the cost, right?
I don't think so. I don't know if you remember, we read a little thing by Philip Eries. He's a French historian, Western Attitudes Towards Death, and it's like a history of the experience of death and dying from, I don't know, roughly 1200s up till now. And it is. It's a history of how we've, really progressed in denial and distancing away from death.
Right.
You know, on one level, you know, you definitely want, you know, medical progress, but we've lost the sense of balance with the whole thing. So, you know, and in that sense, it causes tremendous amount of suffering and refusal. The scales have really tipped, you know, in the denial mode. And just, you know, this sort of desperate belief and desperate attempt to, you know, use technology no matter what and push off death no matter what, as opposed to acknowledging it, making friends with death and dying. And,
right.
Allowing people... The truth and the dignity to sort of consciously die and be with their own dying with a level of acceptance. I saw a brilliant documentary recently. It was called How to Die in Oregon. And,
Good place to die?
Absolutely. I mean, they were the first state that voted in, you know, the voters put it in, a right to die. So that
the voluntary kind of suicide, basically, like assisted suicide, right?
I wouldn't use that term particularly. It's more like, right to die. That's sort of how the movement politically defined itself.
Right to die.
Yeah.
It would be hard to get people behind that.
Well, how it is pretty simple. Is if an individual, through after all the medical stuff, you know, in consultation with their physician, says that they do have an incurable disease, and you know, there's going to be intense suffering involved, that the doctor doesn't assist them, but the doctor writes out a simple prescription for a certain kind of barbiturates, or you know, some kind of barbiturates. And it's like a prescription, and they can go to the pharmacy and they get it filled, and their insurance pays for it, and then they have it. And if and when they wish to peacefully, quietly, consciously transition, they can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the documentary, you know, it began with one gentleman who just took it, and he lays down, and all his family members are around. And some of the last things he says is, you know, I'm so thankful to the voters of Oregon that they've allowed me this option. And then the focus of the whole, you know, it's about an hour show, a little bit more, is this one woman who's, you know, battling cancer. She's in her late 50s, I guess. And, you know, she was pretty successful for a couple of years, but then it kept coming back. So she took this option. And, you know, at the end, you know, they don't show her, but you can hear her voice. They had it recorded. And she said, "This is so easy. This is so easy. I wish more people
right.
knew about this." And then she, you know. And then she died.
Yeah, it reminds me of that Woody Allen joke, I'm not afraid of death, I just don't want to be there when it happens.
Right, well, that's the opposite.
It's one of my favorite
Woody
Allen jokes. But that's a great description. It's one of those things where, you know how we're way more afraid, or we put so much more energy into our fear of a thing that maybe isn't as... Are you hearing like a beeping noise?
You're checking in and out.
In terms of like not being able to hear me, you mean?
You know, the usual cell phone stuff. You're in and out. It's
okay.
Like you're traveling.
Ah, shit. Yeah, all this talk, we've been talking about how it's okay to die. My phone's agreeing. He's thinking it's okay to die. It doesn't apply to you, phone. Shit. Here, I'm going to go back inside and just check.
Okay.
Perception's good. But, what was I going to say? So I was tempted to make a joke about that Oregon Trail game, everybody dying from dysentery in that game. I'm not sure what the joke was going to be. But the other thing... Tonya, can you stop playing on? I'm on the show's recording. Sorry. What was I saying? Wait, I'll remember.
A joke? You were trying to access a joke about the Oregon Trail? Dysentery?
Yeah, there's this old computer game I remember playing as a kid where they people would always die of dysentery in the computer game. But people will know what I'm talking about, people from my age. But that's a terrible segue into something I was going to bring up. So when I've thought about death a lot, I think a lot more than most people. And I've done so from a pretty young age. Like, I'm not
mm-hmm.
sure a day goes by that I don't think about death, my own death, and what that
sure.
means, and what I'm leaving behind, and what I'm doing with my life, why I exist. You know, all these typical existential angsty type of questions. But I remember in class, it was on one of the first days, and I hope you still do this because it was very powerful. You had us basically write down what our first experience with death was.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you still do that exercise in class?
Yes, yes. That's
and I mean the whole class was like crying.
well, like what you said, you know, a day doesn't go by that we don't think about death and dying. And we have zero skills in terms of directly relating with the losses in our life and relating.
Wait, do you think for most people they think about death on a regular basis? Because I feel like most people don't.
I would say everyone does, whether consciously or unconsciously. I'm more on the other end of the spectrum, that we think about death and dying, you know, a couple times a minute. You know,
there's
some sense of, you know, the both the impermanence of everything and the uncertainty of everything. And, you know, one of the functions of the class is to our relationship to death and dying, and that can we use death as sort of a teacher?
Yes. And, yeah, I think I have a different take on death because, well, I'll say this. So, because I need to tie this into the theme of the show, which is called tripolar, you know, bipolar stuff and the mental health angle.
Oh,
and,
okay.
When I was, I'm trying to remember how old I would have been, I was younger than 15, probably somewhere between 11 and 13, I think was my age. I was in elementary school, and I had a friend who was murdered by his own dad.
Oh, my.
Which I wrote a thing on in your class when we had that assignment, and that was the first time I really tried to make sense of that, and that
yeah.
really came back. But that made a huge impact on me because the dad, I mean, I still remember it, just being in the van. We had like a van, my mom driving, and she would drive over the train tracks fast whenever we did it because the car would kind of get a little air, you know, and it would be like really fun. And you see so many things that wouldn't be acceptable anymore, but like whenever there was a train track ahead, my mom would like pedal to the metal like we're getting some air. I remember it was pretty soon after that, you know, it was just a very positive energy. Everyone was having a great time. And then my mom gets a call and she's talking on the phone with her friend. It was like her best friend. Her name's LaVon. And she just starts saying no and, you know, like kind of crying. And immediately, like, knew something was wrong.
Yeah.
And she wouldn't, like, say what happened. And I didn't find out till basically later that night when I was eavesdropping on my parents reading, I think it was the same night, like, reading a newspaper article and hearing that this kid I went to school with, one of my friends from school, along with his, it was at least, I think it was two other kids, and there's a baby that I believe survived, and the dad shot up his family and his wife, too, like, just killed everybody. And he thought that, like, God was telling him to do it through the TV. And my mom told me that he was sick in the head, and he had I just remember hearing them talk about it, and just my feet going cold, and just like kind of trembling, and just imagining that, because.
Hello?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah, you're there again.
Hello?
Yes, can you hear me?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah, no, I can hear you now.
My phone died.
Yeah.
My phone ironically died.
I'll try to just pick up where I left off. Terrible time for it to drop out. But, I remember hearing them read that newspaper article in the kitchen, and I was up in their room just kind of spying, and I heard them read a part about how my friend, his name is Jared Wood, was shot in the back with a hunting rifle while he was running away from the house. And so when I heard that and I just saw this image of, you know, him running through a field and just terrified and then just getting hit with a bullet, like, it was terrifying. And
sure. Traumatizing.
I felt, you know, I felt my feet go cold, my hands go cold, like, I was, like, trembling, you know. And that night I had a dream that he was there, like, he came into my room and I saw him there, and then, like, I don't know, like, it was just really terrifying. And I found out that the explanation for it that was given was that he had a mental disorder. He thought that he was being instructed to kill his family by God through, like, the TV. That he had something called bipolar disorder, and he was on medications for it, but he stopped taking his medications, and he thought he didn't need them anymore. My mom was saying people with that kind of problem, you know, they stop taking their medicine, and they think that they don't need it anymore, and, you know, sometimes they do crazy things. And so to me, the worst thing that you could possibly be is bipolar, you know?
Oh, boy.
And
yeah. Sure.
I never knew, until like the other year, I was officially diagnosed with bipolar disorder, but I don't know, maybe I was subconsciously denying it for a long time. That, like, that was just my greatest fear, was always just that maybe there was something wrong with me like that, and because I would have weird thoughts and feelings, and, you know, I just knew there was something weird about me, and to find out that I guess it happened at an age when I found out where I could cope with it, but to me that was like the worst thing you could be, you know. So I don't know, like, how exactly that informed my view of death, but I mean, the takeaway from it that I would say is like a positive takeaway was that from a very young age I appreciated what it meant to be alive, and I saw the randomness of the world. This was a good kid. He was a Christian. He was a nice guy, you know. And I remember thinking of his friend, his name was Paul, that they left on bad terms. I mean, he died when they were on bad terms. They were best friends, and he said he hated him over some dumb shit. And I remember thinking about that, but I don't know. Like, that made such an impression where I realized that no one's above death, you know.
Yes.
It's a trigger away for anyone and at any time. And that's just death that we inflict on one another. That doesn't account for nature and for disease and, you know, all the various ways that we can die. So, I don't know. Like, I feel like a more in-depth appreciation for my own mortality than it may have otherwise had if I hadn't had a kid murdered like that when I was a kid.
Well, I think actually that's a very valuable insight and shift in your relationship towards you know, mortality and impermanence. It's when, you know, our relationship to death becomes a teacher and vitalizes our relationship to life. You know, because that's, you know, one of the sort of mottos within a lot of the Eastern traditions as well. Death is the best mirror we have to see the truth of life. And it is, essentially our most powerful teacher. And when we forget it, you know, it somehow affects our relationship to the vividness of life and you know, our gratitude towards life and our appreciation towards life. And when we remember it, that enhances our gratitude, our appreciation, our vividness.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you're confronted with, you hear from people all the time, I mean, everyone listening probably has either had a near-death experience or knows someone who has, and it's very apparent that when someone goes through a near-death experience, it changes their perspective on life.
Yeah.
Necessarily. Sure. I mean, there's no way to escape it. Like, they come out of that a different person.
I think so. I think so.
And that's because they're confronting
that reality.
And
all the versions of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the miniature near-death experiences, like what you had when you were a child and you heard about your
mm-hmm.
child, your friend, you know, being killed.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, any near-death experience, you know, if we tune into it, helps us transform and wake up a little bit more.
Yeah, and it makes us more compassionate, I think, when we appreciate that mortality. And that's how this ties into the Syrian thing. There's a picture that went viral of everyone listening to this is probably tech savvy enough to look at the internet. You've probably seen it. There's a guy holding a dead baby that washed up on the shore.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
It. Yes.
You haven't seen it.
I haven't seen the photo, no, but I heard it discussed quite a bit, you know, in the radio and NPR.
Yeah. It's just a visceral image.
And like one woman said, one commentator was very sharp, I thought. She said, you know, hearing about or seeing thousands of people die, you know, it's like, one person, to see one
exactly.
person.
Exactly. That's what I wanted
effect.
To talk about, is exactly that. Because all of a sudden, Americans care about this crisis. And this has been going on for like half a decade. And we don't know shit about it. You know, like we kind of like hear blurbs. Like you said, we hear statistics, you know,
half
a million dead. Or you know, I think it's either Lenin or Stalin is credited with saying one man's death is a tragedy, a million men's death is a statistic. And that's how it is. And it's a bizarre phenomenon that we can be so educated and so you know, we would think aware of what's going on and how to interpret reality. And we hear about all this pain and all the suffering, but we have to see it in a way that's comfortable enough where it's not graphic. Like, cause no one would look at that picture if the baby's like head was cut off or, you know what I mean? Like that picture would have never surfaced if it was too graphic, but it's just graphic enough that it circulates and that you can look at it and feel that pain and empathy and confusion and confliction. You can feel all that without being terrified because most Americans never, I mean, we have such a weird relationship with death in America because it's like we celebrate it with all this violent, you know, video games and movies and TV shows, and we grow up just inundated with
cinematic
and death.
Pretend death. Yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah, and it's like cool and it's fun and it's, you know, the good guy kills the bad guys, and that's just, you know, it's something we're very comfortable with. But at the same time, we don't actually see it and we don't actually understand it because in the movies, the guy gets shot, he's dead. He doesn't bleed out. He doesn't go to the hospital. And, you know, you don't see his kids grow up without a dad. Or like, you know, like we just have a very cartoonish understanding of it, I feel like, until something happens where we're forced to confront it. And we keep ourselves in these bubbles. And it's something like an image like that can bridge that bubble. It's like the perfect conduit to make us appreciate that kind of suffering that we would otherwise just not care about. We'd rather hear about what, you know, Kim Kardashian did. And
there's a moment of identification.
What's your take on that? Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, with the one child and the one photo, there's a moment of sort of a deep identification. Oh my goodness,
mm-hmm.
Death is real, you know.
Right.
It's real. Because we like unreal death, you know, that's fine, that's entertaining. But if it's one person, and one of the commentators said, and by the way, this is a white person, a young white
mm-hmm.
child, so that you know, somehow, you know, has a greater access to our, you know, emotional resonance tones. So, yes, it does. It hits
us. Of course.
And we recognize it, and then it has an effect. You know, I think somewhat similar thing happened when the guy shot the lion, and that went viral. And
yeah,
you know, there was
yeah.
Such a, it was the same thing. This is one gorgeous, beautiful lion, and you know, people started. Well,
and we care about lions all the time.
Yeah, right. It's so that phenomena of, you know, it has to be, or it doesn't have to be, but it's much more effective when it's just one. And there's something about deep emotional identification that
mm-hmm.
seems to be necessary. So it's a deep feeling. Then it becomes real. Other than that, it,
right.
you know, it is. It's like a statistic, which means it's a concept, and I can rationally understand it. And, you know, and that's fine.
It's
and
just data.
Yeah, data. And on, you know, on, relating to it on the level of understanding. You know,
yeah, and human beings are still emotional creatures. We've trained ourselves to think. We try to make decisions based on rationality and logic and all this, but we don't act unless it's an emotional decision when it comes to anything drastic, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, it has to be rooted in, you know, an emotional dimension. For sure.
And a lot of people, I think their sense of empathy isn't enough to feel that emotion necessary to do something or at least care unless it's packaged in a way that's highly accessible, like that picture.
Yeah, yeah. I remember when there were a lot of discussion and photos of one of the journalists being beheaded by ISIS,
mm-hmm.
and it was
mm-hmm.
put on the internet. And I was really curious, so I asked a couple of my classes, how many of you have, you know, actually watched this on the internet? And no hands went up, just one person. And he was, you know, he was an ex-Marine.
Wow.
But everyone, you know, and I remember, you know, hearing all the discussions about it and realizing, like what you just said, you know, that's beyond.
Well, and it's very
threshold.
Hard to find. It's very hard to see. That's a great example because everyone hears about it. You see, like, snippets of it in the news. But if you actually wanted to see it, you can't. And it's a question of why is it that you're not allowed to see it? Is that, obviously, it's a terrible thing, but it's a thing that matters. And why is it that you don't even have the option unless you... you know, go to some really weird website. It was the same thing with the video where they burned the guy, the pilot captured
him. Oh, right.
In that
right.
cage. Like, I actually watched that video. I found it. I watched
uh-huh.
the whole thing. I like, made myself watch it because I wanted to appreciate what's actually going on in the world, you know?
Yeah.
And they're very good at what we just talked about. They're very good at sending... emotional, creating emotional experience with an execution.
Yeah.
It's symbolic. It's they in the same attire that we put our Guantanamo Bay prisoners in. They, you know, it's just really well produced as a. It's so weird about it was that.
Nico, I'm sorry.
Like,
you're breaking up on me. I can't hear you very clearly.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you, but there's an awful lot of distortion.
Really? Are you still having that issue? I'll move back to where I was before. I'm going to upgrade my infrastructure for this show.
If you have to work with this material, it's going to be tricky.
Yeah, it's all right. It takes time, but I can edit it. I'm going to go back outside. I think we're having better reception there. Okay. Going back to the car.
Okay. All right.
I just honked my horn, so when I'm editing it, I can see that spike in the sound. It'll help me get to where I need to cut faster. But
sure.
What I was saying was in regards to the ISIS video where they burned that pilot to death.
Right, right.
When I was watching it, it was something I'd never seen because it was real, but it felt fake because it was so well produced.
In terms of editing and cuts and zooms,
just the way it was laid out, like it felt like a movie, you know. And I'd never seen something so primitive produced in such a it's like a Chapman student made it, you know, like it or better.
Yeah.
And
right. So
it was a cognitive dissonance, I felt, because, you know, there was music. There was everything was laid out in a way that symbolized something. There was a lot to it. So it was like art, you know, they were consciously creating something designed to evoke an emotion and to be pretty much probably just to be a recruitment tool and to be a message to the West to, don't fuck with us is pretty much the takeaway. And
sure.
And at the end, I think they gave like names or addresses of other like pilots and, you know, it was very scary what they did. And so they're people whoever made that, that's someone who understands this kind of phenomenon I'm talking about, this idea that we have to experience something a specific way for it to make a lasting impression on us if we're not directly encountering it in real life. You know, if it's not a near-death experience, it has to be tailored in a very specific way to make someone feel something very close to that if they really were there. And that's what artists do, I think. And that's the value and danger of a good artist, is they're able to manipulate human emotion in a very conscious way. That's what I mean, that's what I do. That's my job, is to write things in a way and show people my vision for how to create a story in a way that it pulls those strings and it makes you feel those. So it's a very, being a screenwriter is weird because you're a very manipulative creature. I mean, your job is to create something imaginary and design it so that it evokes specific emotions. Everything they say, what they're wearing, what music's playing, the way it's shot, just every detail is designed to manipulate you emotionally. And it says something about our culture that we value that so much, and I think rightfully so. It's interesting to me that we really value good filmmaking and that we go to the movies, that we pay money to go watch Chennault narrative that we know didn't really happen.
Yes.
But it's like the artists behind it are trying to make us experience something. And we really value that to the point where we have cinemas, you know, giant buildings all over the country and hundreds of millions of dollars are spent to create these experiences. And it's universal that people really enjoy and appreciate having that. So I don't know exactly where I'm going with that, but
okay. No, we may have touched this once before, but it's not just in the United States. This is a global experience. The power of cinema, you know, as an art form, it is the most powerful art form that has ever existed on the planet. It's true. Beyond novels, beyond opera, beyond painting. And, one understanding of it or one interpretation of the power of it is that its roots are fundamentally in our relationship to dreams. Because a great film is recreated like a dream. And in dreams, everything, that evokes emotions. The whole spectrum is right there. And as well, waking up from the dream. The dream is over. So it's a very, very intensely immersive experience to watch a film as it is to have a dream. And
it's connecting with you on a subconscious level.
Subconscious, preconscious, and then, possibly conscious as well. In terms of being an artist, you have to be aware of, all the techniques that you're going to use and how you're going to evoke this stuff. So, it's a holistic, the ecology of consciousness. It hits every level of it.
Hmm.
And it does, and it speaks. It speaks, an emotional language and an image language.
What do you mean by the ecology?
The ecology of, I don't know, just, when you say unconscious, that's one level, but there are other levels. It's not just unconscious. There's preconsciousness, and there's like subconscious levels.
How would you define preconscious? I'm just curious because I haven't heard that term used. I think I know what you mean, but what is preconsciousness?
Just envision a kind of shading off from clear, articulate images to, a little bit more fuzzy to a little bit more watery down to, the clarity of the water gets opaque and then down into the mud underneath the water. That's what I meant by the ecology, the multi-levels of the consciousness.
Hmm.
And, we have this sort of same experience in our dreams. And, I've been intrigued by a relationship with dreaming, which, in the end, with the Tibetans, all this sort of is seen as also associated with death and dying. Because,
How did they interpret dreams, the Tibetans?
Well, I don't know, interpret.
Could we dismiss them as fancies we have in the night? I think in Western culture, I've always been so fascinated by dreams because part of my condition or whatever's, the way I'm wired, I would snap into episodes where I felt like I was dreaming, but I was conscious.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I was awake, but I felt like I was dreaming.
Yeah,
and it would really fuck with me. And likewise, when I'm dreaming, sometimes I lucid dream, and I've had that since I was younger, but...
Oh, are you? Okay. I've been working on that lately, lucid dreaming. That's
really
interesting. Yeah, actually, I did a whole workshop in this place. It's a Tibetan American center in Colorado. And one of the teachers is, part of what he's teaching and transmitting is, pretty ancient Tibetan stuff, which is, first of all, the closest we... One of the ancient analogies with death is sleep. Okay?
Yes.
So insofar as we investigate sleep, we're in some sense also investigating death. And our relationship with conscious waking life and then that slow transition into sleep and that dreamless sleep as well as dreaming, as well as lucid dreaming, these are all different sort of manifestations of mind, manifestations of our being.
Right.
And to, really be open and inquisitive to that area. And lucid dreaming is a very, it sounds like, some people are just born, like what you just said, with a good facility towards it. And that's fantastic. It can be learned. It's been done, Stephen LaBerge in Stanford has, set up a dream laboratory. And so a lot of scientific work has been done with this. And it is a psychological and, to some degree, spiritual tool. lucid dreaming. Except you have to sort of transcend the entertainment dimension of it. This is, you know, given a kind of Tibetan interest in spirituality and enlightenment. That because if you your facility with lucid dreaming, you can fly, you know, you can go wherever you want, you can have sex and all. So it's like the ultimate home entertainment center in some level. But at the end, you know, that sort of, you know, leaves one sort of, okay, you know, what else? And that is a that can be a transition from lucid dreaming to dream yoga. That's where the relationship to dreams takes on a little bit more spiritual component, a kind of evolution of consciousness component, where you can actually learn more deeply the notion of meditation and an enlightened mind within dream yoga. And then possibly you can evolve into what's called a sleep yoga, where you, in some sense, instead of just blacking out, which most of us do at night, black out, that there is some awareness that is still maintained throughout that dreamless sleep state without waking up. And that, you know, his phrase is, you know, the Buddha never sleeps. I mean, yes, you know, Buddha's rest and all this other stuff, but they're 24 hours, you know, on, if you will.
Right, they're Walmarts.
And that familiarity with those states of mind is very beneficial when it's time to die. That instead of, you know, I'm not afraid to die, I just don't want to be there. I want to be there when it happens. I want to be there when I transition into sleep. There's some sense, you know, at least within this tradition, of if you can, you know, in some sense accomplish that, you can be of great benefit to yourself and to others in terms of, you know, ridding us of all this fear that we have all the time. And, you know, as I said, making friends with death and dying. And because who knows, one of the reasons why we're so afraid of death is it's the unknown. And one of the things about dreams is they're real. Inside them, they are real. They are absolutely real. And then we wake up. Oh, you know, and the only reason we see them as dreams is because we wake up and we have this consciousness that we share with each other. And we can look back in contrast and say, oh, it was just a dream.
I like that someone else has said that, because I've felt that what you just said 100%. And I have so much compassion for people who are not sane, because imagine being in a dream you don't wake up from. It doesn't matter what's going on outside that dream. It doesn't matter what everyone else says is real. If to you that's reality, that's reality. I mean, what we experience is reality. If someone were to come and tell us, hey, you're in the Matrix, like that, okay, so what? I still got, you know, what does that mean? So what?
Right.
You know, this is what I experienced. This is, unless there's some way out of here, this is it. This is, and so when someone's insane, like, to just dismiss them as insane, it really bothers me, especially when there's people commit acts like this guy did where he killed his family.
Sure.
And when they just say he was crazy, and like, okay, but that's it? That's the end of the investigation? You know, no, what was he experiencing? Why did he think that was the thing to do? You know, because obviously he really believed it. And is that, we just need to understand what that is and where that's coming from. And because most people have never experienced anything like that and hopefully never will. But if you're in a position where your sanity is called into question,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
your experience of reality is lucid, like you're in a dream,
mm-hmm.
that's terrifying and dangerous. And at the same time, I think key to our evolution, understanding, you know, these things you're talking about that we don't even really get this, you know, like Marcus Aurelius, he's my favorite emperor. I read his book when I was in like high school. I'm trying to remember the name. I think it was just called
Meditations.
Meditations.
Yeah.
And that's when I first really started
identifying with this idea that you brought up of death and dreams being interlinked, because he would say from the dream of life to the dream of sleep is like something he would always say. Mm-hmm. And I was like, whoa, you know, he sees like dreams as, like, he doesn't see this line between here's what's real and here's what's not. It's like life is a dream to the dream. And I wrote a script that's my favorite thing I ever wrote.
Interesting.
And it's right now it made the top 5% of something called the Nickel Fellowship, which is like the World Series of screenwriting competitions.
Oh,
and
great.
Yeah, and I have people reading it right now that, you know, some executives and managers, and I'm hoping something happens with it. Everyone's going to say it's too violent, too controversial, no one's going to want to make it. But it's built on these themes we're discussing, and it's about a guy who dreams he's in places so he dreams he's in a different place and time where something terrible happened. But he knows what's about to happen, so he's in a position to change it. And then when he wakes up, history's been changed based on what he did in his dreams. So to him, there is no dream. You know, it's just time travel. And he's drawn, there's a sort of destiny he's kind of pushed towards to confront something about his own past as the ramifications of the things he's changed in the past come to collide with his, what we would call reality, you know, his waking life. And
I
used real tragedies in the movie, like Columbine and like these things people don't really know about, real like shootings. And because I wanted people's experience, I wanted the movie to say, I wanted it to hit home. I wanted people to merge this line they draw between real and fake. You know how before every movie it'll be like, you know, any characterizations are purely coincidental and there's nothing like, you know. I'm like, why are you such a pussy? Like, what are you afraid of that someone mistakes it for reality? Like, why is that line? And I think I took it out because I knew that people read this, they're not going to, that's what everyone said, that, oh, it's great, but it's too controversial. But I wrote the very first thing before the movie starts is that all the characters in this movie, you know, are real, basically. Or, there was like the opposite of a disclaimer where it said everything's as accurate as possible for the real tragedies that occurred. And I did as much research as I could. I recreated these events because I wanted it to hit home for people. And it was the hardest thing I've ever written. But it's the thing I'm most proud of. And I felt like when I finished it, I was like, okay, I could die. Like, I'm done. You know, I could die tomorrow. I don't give a shit. Like, my job's done. But
that's a good feeling.
Hopefully it gets made. I don't know. But, it's just this. There definitely is a line we try to draw between conscious and unconscious. And when people transcend that line or blur it or explore these other variations of consciousness, like I know you do and you encourage others to do, there's a lot of kind of silent, you know, blowback for that. Like, we don't like that as a society, I feel like, in Western culture.
Yeah, I think in terms of the basic organization of ourselves, we don't.
Yeah, and I encourage anyone listening to get into meditation and get into,
meditation, lucid dreaming, you know, I think that those are very good, practices to engage in. And, you know, dreaming is fun, and lucid dreaming is a great deal of fun. And it is also an arena for very rapid, I think, at least within the Tibetan tradition, for very rapid spiritual development. And maybe one of the payoffs for this is, no matter how frightening or scary or painful a dream is, when we wake up, it's like, oh, okay, it was just a dream.
That was just a dream. And I think that might happen when we die.
Exactly. That's exactly the next step. It's like we we die.
Oh, that
we
was just
up.
A dream.
Yeah.
Yeah, and whatever happens, like, to me, it's like an opposite of Pascal's wager, where it's like, either way, I'm not worried. Because either I'm going to die in this blackness, like atheists think, or, you know, like they relate it to sleep.
Yeah, dreamless sleep, and we just black
right.
out.
So if my consciousness just retires and that's the end of it, okay, whatever. But if something else happens,
mm-hmm.
cool. You know, I know it's not going to be like hell. I mean the logistics of that just don't pan out. it'd be way too hard to manage hell. And God wouldn't make that. It makes no sense. But I don't know what there is. I have no idea. And that's what scares people, is just that.
Yes,
not
it's a
knowing.
Not knowing. So, it's a not knowing.
So I think we insert something there. Okay, so Plato, I believe it was either Plato or Socrates. I always confuse the two. There was a quote that really stuck with me my freshman year at college. And that was, those who tell stories rule society. And I was like, what was this guy just, you know, really being really cocky, you know, like, because he's good at, like, writing. He's a good writer, and he's just, like, talking shit. He's drunk or something. But, you know, as I grew up, I feel like I'm more and more seeing what it means, because there's this natural tendency to need to insert a narrative in certain. It's like with a gun, you have a clip you need to put in. Like, I feel like everyone's born and they have like they need something to load in there where it explains why I exist, what I'm supposed to do, what happens when I die. And cultures have different variations of this, and a lot of times they fall into very similar storylines. But I think that's kind of what he was referring to. And leaders,
yes.
You know, they paint these – good leaders are good storytellers.
Yep.
And that's what they do. They create a narrative that says, this is the bad guy, we're the good guy, here's why. And here's what we need to do, and here's how we're going to be remembered. And he, you know, and they can say whatever they want. You know, like with Hitler, he had this whole belief in this Aryan race, and he brainwashed Germany to believe they were this superior creatures, and they needed to exterminate, you know, the inferior one. It was just like Darwinism on steroids.
Mm.
And,
and
you know, that's what he was good at, telling stories. He was good at, and he took extreme steps to. I mean, he was an evil genius. You know, he found a way to convince an entire population that they were these superior creatures, and that they could and were destined to take over the world and run it, you know, and just be running shit.
Yeah.
And you know, we're at a stage in history where it is a statistic. You know, we look back on that and it's at a point where it's like, if he would have won, society would be this way, maybe it would be better. Or maybe, you know, it's like what happened with the Native Americans. Like, the Europeans wiped them out as a complete, total tragedy. Now we're just like, okay, but we got a good country out of it. And like, so I feel like we're at that point in history, enough times passed where, you know, if he'd won, if he'd lost, whatever, it's like, what's the better society? But the movie I was referring to that made me reach out to you was, it really turned those statistics into people for me again. And it changed my perspective on that, you know, like being able to talk about these historical things as just like pieces on a chessboard, you know, 'cause that's what we do. We zoom way out and it's just like, oh, he invaded here and they won this war and they won this battle and this is why they lost the war. And, like, we just create a story, and that's the story. But, you know, this guy created this movie, and he was a kid who lived through the Nazis invading these Baltic countries. And people don't really know about this or think about it as much as, like, the Jews being killed in the Holocaust. But, you know, millions and millions of Eastern European and, Russian people.
Enormous.
Way more.
Enormous. And
were slaughtered just the same, and I don't think it gets the same attention just because Jewish people are better storytellers at the end of the day. I think they're that's their tradition. I mean, from the get-go, it's like they were really good at telling stories, like remembering things and creating narratives. And they created the Bible, and they create, you know, and they pass stories along. And I think thousands of years ago, like when you see that today, like I think that's why Jews run Hollywood. It's not because like it's just a fraternal thing. I think it's because they're good storytellers. Like, you know, just by nature, a lot of Jewish people are just good at telling stories. So that's why we hear that story more. But, you know, the same thing happened to a lot of different people.
Yes,
and he made this movie where he's a boy. I think he's basically recounting or just creating like a dream, basically, where we saw what his life was like or what it was like to be then and there. And this movie was made years and years and years ago. It's like, I don't remember the exact date. It was like 70s, 80s, you know, maybe even early. I don't know. It was an older movie. But it is the most powerful portrayal of war I've ever seen in my life. And it, it doesn't show, I don't think it really shows any graphic violence. You see the aftermath of and the anticipation of and the fear of just these horrendous acts. And just to see, and it doesn't speed up and skip it is what this movie doesn't do, which is what American movies do for the most part. They're really exceptional.
Time compression. Like,
exactly. So it's like you get the idea, like the guy cocks the gun, cut to the next scene.
Right.
No, this is, you see 30 bodies outside the building that were lined up and shot, and that's this kid's family. And you see him look at it. You know, it's like these images that you don't want to see. And then the filmmaker, he interlinked it with real footage at the end of like people from the Holocaust and like and this kid's like shooting a picture of Hitler after this just horrendous, horrendous few days he's been through. That where he's just, I can't really do it justice through words, but this boy has become something else at the end of the movie, and you see him just shooting this picture of Hitler, and just you're seeing his thoughts, and you're just, and then you're conceptualizing as like people historically look. You're seeing the war, real footage of like just different phases of what's going on, big picture, and he's shooting this picture, and you're just feeling his just anger and frustration and bitterness towards this thing that consumed his world, it's so powerful. And I encourage you to take a look at it maybe for your class, because it really shook me up. And a movie hasn't shaken me up in a long time, because I'm so familiar with the way movies are made. And, you know, I have a lot more distance from it.
That's great to hear, and it's a good experience for you, too. Yeah, I mean, since you're, you know, so that's your profession, that's your field. So to actually find one.
Yeah, it was before all these effects, you know, like they were really blowing up force, and they were really burning things down, and it seemed like they were real bullets. I mean, there's just a sense of realism to it that's menacing, and that I think is glossed over in today's movies. Or just, it's not really, we don't recreate the world. Like, you could watch fucking Transformers, they destroy New York City, and you don't give a shit, because it doesn't, you know, like, it doesn't seem real at all. Like, it looks real, I guess. That's how, like, a building would break. But you don't give a fuck, because it doesn't. But you, if you watch a movie like this, it's just like, oh, my God. Like, you know, just you appreciate it, and it becomes real. Or as close to real as it can be without actually being real.
That's great. That's a good definition of the movie. And what's the name of the movie?
Fuck. I should know. I'll link to it. Wait, I'm trying to remember.
Or the director?
I sent it. Here, let me look up the email I sent you originally. Because I know I said it there. And I need to say it in the actual episode.
Mm-hmm.
So let me find it.
Sure.
And it's all in another language, by the way, which everyone's going to hate. No one's going to want to watch it, but still watch it, because I forgot they were subtitled. You know, that's how good this movie was.
Sure, sure.
All right.
I mean,
let me see,
I remember showing Ikiru in our death class. That was the same deal in Japanese.
Yeah, and that's a great that's another movie that left a huge impression on me.
Well, yeah, definitely. Well, Kurosawa is he's one of the greats.
Yeah, and he has that other movie, Rashomon.
Yeah, I know that.
Where you see the same story from like four perspectives.
Right.
And it makes you really question, you know, what is the. It goes back to that those who tell stories, real society idea.
Yeah.
What story is true? That we're what are we going to pick? And that governs decisions, and that governs everything. Like which story is true? Okay, I'm finding this email I wrote you. Come and See, it's called. And it came out in 1985.
Come and See?
Come and See.
Okay.
Is what it translates to.
Interesting.
And,
1985, okay.
1985, so 3 years before I was born, this thing came out. And that to me is just amazing. And it speaks to the fact that a real artist can tell a story that will transcend time.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
Because none of the technology we have today was available to him. And he was able to tell a story in a way that, it's like a great play or something where it's just, even today, if it's done well enough, it still carries a lot of weight. And
Definitely.
And that's like the serious thing. It's like we have to take it seriously. making a joke while I say we got to take it seriously. But, you know, it's like we're our decision and how we choose to frame the story is impacting a lot of people. And we can't escape the effects of it. Our decision to abstain from interacting for better or worse has led to the current reality that there's a lot of people need a home. And it's like reaching a point where we can't ignore it. And that's, we're seeing that with a lot of, we're seeing that with climate change, I think. Like, we're seeing that with, there's problems that we, like we were talking about earlier, we dismiss, we ignore, we pretend don't exist outside our car, outside our bubble. But eventually they're right outside our car, and they start trying to get into our bubble. And that's when it's like, we really better do something or it's too late. And storytellers warn you before that happens.
This reminds me of where we began this conversation in terms of distancing and denial of death.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, that's sort of the, you know, the root metaphor, the root model. And if we can, you know, begin to not deny and distance ourselves from it, you know, the problems we encounter, we'll encounter them much more quickly, more clearly, more accurately, and probably more creatively.
Well, and this is why we need more people like you out there, because it's a delicate thing. It's not easy to come to that realization that death's real and to appreciate that fact and empathize with the suffering of others and be in a position to live your life in a way that is impactful and meaningful without being drowned by the reality of something depressing. You know, like it's hard to not be debilitated by and overwhelmed by that. And I think that's why we just ignore it, because it's too tricky, or we don't have a good way to deal with it, so we just ignore it, which is the wrong response. Like the right response, or you get these activists who just like shouting at you, you know, and you're forced to.
Right.
That can be effective, but that's not how we're gonna create a whole culture that is in sync, you know, and is able to act thoughtfully and effectively to solve problems. We need to kind of collectively come to terms with this, I think, you know?
Sure. No.
And that's why we need people like you who are sort of Sherpas up this mountain. Or, you know, we need artists and we need teachers like you who can get people to kind of slowly let that percolate.
Yeah. Well put. Hey, listen, my friend. On that note, I think I'm gonna sort of end our conversation for today.
Go do some lucid dreaming.
I've been working on that, you know, I would say for, about 2 years now, in terms, you know, all the stages and, you know, beginning with writing
down
stuff, the dreams.
Like, do you stuff like look down at your hands and or try
yeah,
to like...
Yeah, all the techniques, you know, and have a notebook there. And it's very, I think it's very, you know, it's both fun and it's enlarging and, you know, we do sleep. We spend a lot of our life sleep and dream. And I think the more, the more awareness, you know, I can bring to that, the better.
And they say most people don't remember the majority of their dreams, which makes it even
vast weirder. You know, and almost all the scientific studies, I mean, you know, the 90-minute periods of REM and all the rest of it, you know, we're just sort of at the early stages of discovering this stuff. So it's pretty exciting.
In the relativity of time, where it's like you could, like our life could be a dream. Like we could die and wake up as another guy. And like that's kind of what gave me the idea. Is that, and it would just be like, that was a weird dream. You know, it's like, it's a mind fuck. But,
and when we maintain a little bit of that awareness in our ordinary, everyday human life, we don't get freaked out as much. It's like, okay, you know, and I can extend myself here and I can, you know, I don't have to react because, you know, this is sort of more dreamlike. So it's more playful and less fearful, more playful.
Yeah, well, let me know if you, in your lucid dreaming, you know, training and experience, if you find a way to, my brain's a dick. What my brain does is, when I realize I'm dreaming and I take the controls, it like hits a self-destruct button and I wake up like I'm about to have sex with a beautiful woman because like I realize I'm dreaming. I'm like, I got this. Like, this is what I'm ordering, and like she'll show up and I'll like move in, and then it's like I start waking up. And I'm like, oh god damn, you know, or I'm flying, and then it's just like, no, you're not allowed. It's like there's regulators. There's people in my brain like, no, you know, he's taking over. We're busy. Like, stop. You're not supposed to be conscious right now. We're waking you up. So
yeah, I have your email, so I'll send you a couple of CDs and stuff that you might find interesting in terms of
give me a way
how
to
develop
override
skills.
Those guys.
Yeah.
All right.
So
Thanks so much for doing the show. I apologize for all the technical difficulties, but
no problem.
Like you said,
no problem.
It is the cosmos maybe saying not to record it at the time we were supposed to originally, which I'm glad because I was in a pretty like hypomanic state last time, and it would have been a maybe way worse show. I don't know. And I would have said some shit that like ended my career.
Do let me know when you send it out there.
Oh,
and,
for sure. It'll be a few weeks, but you'll see it for sure.
Yeah, and I, as I said, I'll send you the little stuff I have in terms of the lucid dreaming and dream yoga stuff. And let's maintain contact.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. Do you have anything you want me to promote or tell people about?
No, nothing in particular, you know, be kind, you know?
All right.
Practice kindness, and maybe investigate lucid dreaming.
All right, I'll tell them.
All right.
What's the best resource for them to do that?
The lucid dreaming?
Yeah, you've mentioned things before, but I'll just let you say at the end in case anyone listening wants to write some shit down or whatever.
I would recommend there's this 5 or 6 CD set. The author is Andrew Holecek. It's Holecek, Andrew Holecek. And it's just called Dream Yoga. So he lays the whole thing out and gives a really good context, both scientifically and sort of spiritually.
That sounds great, but you're dreaming if you think people have CD players. they got to find another version.
Someone ripped
that CD and put it on Pirate Bay.
Yeah, I'm sure it already is. I'm sure it already is.
That's where we'll link the Pirate Bay. But no, yeah, thanks so much for calling the show. I think this has been, hopefully everything worked, and I think we had a really good conversation that people will hopefully benefit from.
I hope so, my friend. I hope so. And I'm glad you're doing this. So keep going with it.
All right, I will. Thank you. And you had a big impact on me as a thinker, you know, as an intellectual. And I want you to know that, you know, wherever I take my, I don't know, things academically speaking or in trying to explore these different things, you had a big impact on opening me up to those possibilities and you know, feeding my curiosity and just seeing academia as something that's not just as boring, like series of hoops you got to jump through, but what it should be is what you're doing, and you know, really pushing the boundaries and then relating what you kind of uncover the best you can to future explorers, you know.
Yes, good. Well, thank you very much. More to come, so onwards.
Indeed. All right. Good night, Professor.
Good night.
All right. So that concludes the technical difficulty-laden journey of this interview with Professor Bernard McGrain, full tenured professor at Chapman University in Orange County, California. He's got tenure. He can say whatever the hell he wants. They can't fire him. And he's one of the best professors there. So anyone listening who goes to Chapman, go to meet him. Go in his office hours. Go take his class. Get into the honors program. I think you have to apply and do that. You got to be smart. Be smart. Get into this honors program. Take his class. If you don't get in, if I can show up anyways, he probably won't care. And see, I'm going here. Kiss my ass. He's a great teacher, and it's rare to find someone who's as committed as he is to genuinely opening your mind to something that will stay there permanently and that is good to have received. So take his class if that's possible, and feel free to contact me through the website if you want me to relay anything to him. Tripolarpodcast.com, and our email is tripolarpodcast@gmail.com. You can listen to the show on the website. You can stream it. You can download it. You can listen to it on iTunes. You can listen to it through something called Player FM on Android. Download that app. Awesome app. It's the equivalent of iTunes for Android operating systems, I would say. And, hope you guys took something away from this. And Phillips was going to be my sponsor. I was going to, you know, push their stuff. It didn't work tonight. That I want you to know that's not Phillips' fault, probably. You should still get those headphones. I messed up. I have some issues I need to sort out with my technological infrastructure here. But Phillips headphones are awesome, and I think you should get these Bluetooth bad boys before they run out. All right. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And enjoy your constant journey from the dream of life to the dream of death, to the dream of dreams, to, you know, you can dream it, you can do it, whatever. Bye.